right now.
And instead, the ambassadors of peace shall weep bitterly, as Isaiah 33 and verse 7 says. Whether it's Cuba or Israel, peace deals are at the heart of the top stories this week. Will they hold, or are they a trap? We'll find out on today's Trumpet World. Well, the Gaza war is coming to an end. That's the main headline this week, according to a lot of the media. Is that true? Israel and Hamas have a ceasefire deal. Is it a good deal? Will it last? Is it even a desirable deal? Should it last? Well, I'm joined by our Middle Eastern correspondent, Mihailo Zekic, to try and get to the grips of some of those questions. So, Mihailo, first of all, briefly, what is in this deal?
Well, the deal is divided into three phases, the first of which is the only one so far agreed to. Phase one will last 42 days and comes in effect Sunday. Hamas will release 33 hostages, mainly female hostages, including female IDF soldiers captured on October 7th, the elderly and those that are injured and children. We don't know how many of those are dead or alive, and part of me wonders if Hamas even knows themselves at this point. But those hostages will be released in exchange for, according to the official, I guess, offer is 30 Palestinian prisoners from Israel for every civilian and 50 Palestinian prisoners for every female Israeli soldier. And that number ultimately came up to about 3,000 Palestinian prisoners originally, and then since there's been rumblings of the number may have been revised. But still, a large number of people in Israeli jails being released for these hostages, including many, many convicted terrorists. The Israeli Defense Forces also will agree to withdraw from central Gaza to the border regions, allow the civilian population of Gaza to come back in, and to allow 600 trucks worth of humanitarian aid to enter Gaza. The second phase of negotiations will start on February 5th, and the goal for those is to have negotiate a complete IDF withdrawal from Gaza in exchange for releasing all of the hostages, again, dead or alive. This would be the Israeli men soldiers that are still in captivity. And then phase three would be supervising the reconstruction of Gaza as supervised by Egypt, Qatar, and the United Nations. But so far, only the first section of the first phase of the deal is the one most likely to happen.
And that, I guess, is a big part of my next question is, like, is this the end of the Gaza war? Is this even designed to, whether it works or not, you know, is this kind of designed to be the end of the Gaza war? Or we did have a hostage deal earlier in the war where there was a pause in fighting, hostages were released, and then we went back to fighting. Where does this fall?
Depends on who you ask. If you ask U.S. President Joe Biden, it is official. The war is over, and he has gone down in history as the president that brought peace to the Middle East. I speak as a fool, of course. The implication is, according to analysis from the Institute of the Study of War, which is a real respected think tank, is that it looks like if negotiations with phase two fall apart, then there's going to be another resumption of fighting. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, for his part, I don't think he wants to stop fighting. I know he doesn't want to stop fighting, but I don't think he went into this expecting this to be a lasting peace deal. He's under a lot of pressure from home to get the hostages back. There has been very little progress in the war. There's nowhere left for the IDF to go in Gaza. They continually make raids, and Hamas still hasn't surrendered, and people haven't heard a peep of what most of the hostages are like for months now. And so I'm suspecting this is probably what he's interested in getting into. This is more just a morale booster, which, and then from his perspective, hopefully will fall apart as soon as everybody that he's promised to get in this phase one gets out of there, and then they could start fighting again.
Okay, so this seems like it kind of gives some ground to those that are calling for a peace deal. It shows that he's tried a peace deal, that Benjamin Netanyahu has tried a peace deal. it's probably going to fall apart. That's kind of, you think Benjamin Netanyahu is expecting this to fail?
Not even just him, but a lot of people within his coalition, like Itamar Ben-Gvir and his Jewish Power Party, they've already said that they're going to withdraw from the coalition if this passes through the cabinet. And it's important to know that the security cabinet today has voted to accept the peace deal, but the general cabinet votes tomorrow. So there is still potential for some wrangling on.
But if Ben-Gvir is threatening to quit the cabinet, that seems to imply that he doesn't see this as just a temporary thing and we can get back to fighting, but something that's more of a permanent solution, I guess. So not solution, but a permanent peace.
That's true. And also another coalition partner, Bezalel Smotrich, has made similar threats. But with that being said, Netanyahu and Ben-Gvir don't have the best relationship and really haven't since they became coalition partners, but they stuck together out of convenience. So there may not necessarily be complete communication between the two of them either.
So is this a good deal?
In a perfect world, no. This is probably about the best deal at this point Netanyahu could expect for a number of reasons. One of them is this deal is basically based off of a deal that Joe Biden pitched to the United Nations in May and that Israel refused. But now they're accepting it, and there are indications that the incoming administration of President Trump may have actually been on board with it. For what reason? We don't know. There's been a lot of speculation, but perhaps Trump pouring cold water over Netanyahu's plans, saying, no, we're not going to give you the carte blanche you're expecting us to give you. That might have been the straw that broke the camel's back. Steve Witkoff, the Trump's envoy for the Middle East, he made an impromptu stop to Israel last Saturday, and Benjamin Netanyahu said, it's the Shabbat, I can't really necessarily meet with you right now. And Witkoff's answer was, I don't care, I have a message for you, and apparently harangued Netanyahu for not accepting the deal. There's a lot of questions as to whether Trump is trying to maybe get good optics coming into the inauguration to make it look like Reagan's inauguration when the Iranian hostages were released in 1981, or there's even some rumors that maybe Witkoff has some shady business dealings with the Qataris, and who of course are Hamas's sponsor, and that might have something to do with it. We don't know, but there is a lot of, I guess, issues with this deal that are midgetable, if I'm using that word correctly. Obviously, those 3,000
can be mitigated.
Mitigated. Yeah. There we go. Thank you. Like, for example, the 3,000 Palestinian prisoners. We don't have a list of who exactly is getting released just yet. But the last time that happened, a lot of those were like teenage boys that threw stones at tanks. And as soon as they were released, they started throwing stones again and got swept up into the prison system again. So it's not like there's going to be 3,000 Osama bin Ladens like miraculously overnight popped out, most likely. And again, if things do fall apart, then Israel's just going to come right back into the Gaza Strip and take where they left off, and there's going to be, you know, a lot of the things that they would have traded in are very easily acquirable after the fact, if, again, things don't go to plan. But if this is a permanent ceasefire and Israel does stand down, this basically means Hamas has been legitimized by the international community and it's probably not going to happen right away, but is giving them one way or another free rein to go and build Gaza back up to what they had before, which is, of course, what led up to October 7th. So if Netanyahu's gambling failed in this perspective and this is the end of the story, then this would definitely be extremely serious for Israel.
So I guess it first sounded like you were saying it's not too bad. Just that last sentence there, though, you were saying it could be very bad.
It could be very bad if Netanyahu doesn't play his cards right. If this is an intention to let everything fall apart at this point and get the hostages out while they can, then not really much would change per se. But if he feels like his hands are tied and that he lets this go, then this would be bad. With that being said, I mentioned President Trump and some of his pressure. I mean, a lot of the people coming in through his administration have already said there's no way we're letting Hamas like rear its ugly head up again. And Trump, for his part, has made a lot of threats to Hamas about releasing like all the hostages.
I guess I wanted to get to the Trump angle a little bit later. What I wanted to nail down first, though, is this a good deal or is it a bad deal?
It all depends on what happens once Trump gets back into office. If this is maybe him giving Netanyahu the wink, like, oh, yeah, you must go and do this, and then we'll talk about finishing Hamas off after I get into office, then it would be about as good as it could get. If not, and if Trump is actually seriously adopting Joe Biden's proposal, which he hasn't really adopted much from Biden to this point, so that in itself is pretty suspect, but if that is the case, then it could be pretty bad for Israel.
But I guess, I mean, this deal covers what's going to happen over the next 6 weeks, and then if you play that out another 6 weeks and another 6 weeks, like, we don't need to know about what Donald Trump is going to do to know that whether Israel, what the Israel is signing up to, whether that's good or bad.
Well, I guess the for phase one itself, on the ground, if you ignore anything else that could follow, this is about as good as a deal as Israel can get. Once you get to negotiating phase two, that will determine on whether or not it can turn good or bad. But at least at the moment, this is basically the best he could have asked for. And for not just, say, the international pressure, he also, Mr. Netanyahu, has a lot of pressure in the home front as well. There's been a lot of people want the hostages back. They haven't heard news about them for a long time. There has been no progress in the war, for the most part, of recovering them, of getting Hamas to surrender. This is going to be a huge morale booster for a very war-weary Israeli public when there hasn't really been much updates one way or another, even though the IDF has been doing the best they could. So that could relieve a lot of pressure he had from some of his political opponents and from people on the street.
Well, okay. I mean, you seem a lot more positive about the deal than I think a lot of other people that I've read, Carolyn Glick, Melanie Phillips, some of these others. I think they've generally, Carolyn Glick in particular, has been pretty scathing about this deal. And I guess it is easy to be very critical, but not deal with the complexities of the situation. I mean, I do tend to think, personally, if you're dealing with terrorists, you're in a really bad spot. And if it were me, I think I would just stick with unconditional surrender. That's all that we will accept from you. And I think negotiating with terrorists is always a bad thing. And there's the risk of incentivizing more hostage taking later. I think there's the point that people have made that Yair Sinwar himself was once in Israeli prison and he was released. But I did want to bring in Andrew on this then, with at least a lot of this talk from a lot of other people on this being a negative deal. I mean, what is your take? I think this is something I've seen a lot of discussion about this week, that Donald Trump has how much Donald Trump is behind this, but Donald Trump's negotiator at least it seems like they've pushed Israel into a deal that Israel doesn't want, and that a lot of Israelis, you know, don't want to be here. Is this a turn? Is this a change? Like, is this Donald Trump turning against Israel, or what do you see going on here? Hopefully, we don't have a repeat of last week. Can you hear me, Andrew?
Sorry.
There we go. I think we froze for a second.
Can you repeat the question again?
Yeah, sorry. I think I can see you're a bit fuzzy. I think we've had some internet pauses. But we're just, do you have anything on this, the kind of the Trump angle, the American angle, like what Donald Trump, how involved he was in this deal or what his role was?
Well, like I said, he's not the president yet. It seems like a number of people keep forgetting that. He's not inaugurated till Monday. So I think the Biden administration definitely had a strong hand in crafting the terms. I do think Trump may be over-eager for what could very well turn out to be a bad deal, just because the last time I heard him address this in a press conference, he was hearkening back to what happened in the 1980 during the Iran hostage crisis, how Iran had hostages. They refused to release them to the Carter administration and then released them the day Reagan was inaugurated into office. And Trump said, he's like, my administration, it's going to be like that. He said, if those hostages are not released by my inauguration, there's going to be serious consequences for Hamas. So it sounded like he was at least putting a threat on Hamas that, like, if they're not released by the time I get into office, we're coming after you. And that seemed like a pretty strong principled stance that, like, if you don't release them, we're coming after you. However, in his eagerness to kind of appear as the modern Reagan and have that those hostages out by Monday when he takes the oath of office, he may have been more willing than he should have been to accept the terms of a bad deal instead of actually letting those hostages remain in Hamas and then do like he said he was going to do during the press conference and just totally ramp the war against Hamas up to 11 when he was in office.
I mean, I guess one of the things that shapes my view of the deal is just seeing all of the people partying, all of the Hamas supporters partying, as this deal is signed. It certainly seems like they're very happy about it. And then, as Carolyn Glicks pointed out as well, it's all very well and good to say, okay, well, we can go back in there later, but Israeli soldiers died to take the territory that they did, and if we retreat and then have to go back in again after, if Hamas break the deal, more Israeli soldiers are going to die. But I mean, I do get the point as well, though, about the trying to manage public opinion. But yeah, what you mentioned Donald Trump, and you thought maybe, again, you mentioned the same thing about the hostage deal. I mean, I think also it is probably, like Andrew said, he's not the president yet, and right now there is much more scope for, say, his negotiator to act more independently. He's not sitting in the
That
White
is very
House. He
fair.
doesn't have the White House telephone, the operators, the chain of command, where he can really kind of impose his will and what he wants done. So I think it is, people can use this time period to act out their own ideas. And I definitely think it is way too premature to kind of say, well, Donald Trump has changed his views on Israel or on what's going on here.
Of course. And obviously Mr. Netanyahu knows that as well. Like, I think if he felt like if he just waited one more week and everything was going to get better, he would have waited one more week. And there are other aspects to this that, again, you won't hear me quote him often, but Vladimir Lenin once said, sometimes you have to take two steps backwards to take a step forward. And I think it could very well be a bit of that in play. Like, if at this point there is nowhere left for the IDF to go into Gaza, they've been through the whole thing. They're constantly conducting raids, and they're not finding the people they need to find. And they're not finding the hostages. They're not finding the military units of Hamas. They're not finding the new leaders of Hamas, etc. At this point, it's a stalemate, and nothing is going to be changing. And even though the ball is in Israel's court, like, even though they have the firepower, they have the manpower, etc., and they're pumping that into Gaza, nothing's changing. If they were to offer a carrot and back away a little bit, then maybe some of those military units will start rearing their ugly heads and they'll find out where they are. Maybe they'll get a little sense of, once the hostages start getting released, they'll get an idea, okay, that's where they're actually keeping them, and then now we know where to look for things. So I think that might also be a very important factor that's coming into Netanyahu's thinking.
That is a good point. And I think it is worth noting that throughout this whole thing, Benjamin Netanyahu, I think, has done very well. And he has stood up incredibly to the pressure he's getting from abroad and the pressure that he's getting at home. So again, I also think it would be premature to say he's caved to the pressure, he's caved in and signed a bad deal. He may well have a broader plan in mind, I think, exactly as you're pointing out there. And yeah, I do think it would be premature to say he's caved in to sign a bad deal, just as it would be premature to say Donald Trump has pushed a bad deal. So we still have to wait and see how this rolls out. But we do have some pretty specific expectations. I mean, the Bible has some very specific things to say about this overall principle of Israel and peace deals. And even history has shown us Israel has made some pretty big mistakes in recent history with peace deals.
Well, you could basically say the whole history of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, at least in modern times, going to the Oslo Accords with everything going on, has been one disaster after another, whether you're talking about the intifadas or withdrawing from Gaza, which caused this mess in the first place, or whatever. And our editor-in-chief, Mr. Chip Fleury, has had quite a bit to say about that, particularly in the context of one pardon me, one verse in the book of Hosea, that's in chapter 5, verse 13, which says, when Ephraim saw his sickness and Judah saw his wound, then went Ephraim to the Assyrian and sent to King Jareb, yet could he not heal you nor cure you of your wound. There's a lot to unpack in that verse, especially the prophetic identities of peoples. But the main focus that Mr. Fleury, every time he talks about this verse, is on that word wound. And if you look at what the Hebrew meaning of that word, the root words, etc., it actually means like bandaging up or a remedy. And Mr. Fleury has repeatedly said, in other words, the remedy is the wound. Israel's trying to fix something and it's making a wound deeper. And he's tied that to the peace process with the Palestinians. He said that most recently, prominently, I don't think he said that since, in a Key of David clip a few months after October 7th happened. Unfortunately, don't have the exact date, but he gave an overview on this.
They always keep having these peace pacts, and what's wrong? They have all these peace pacts, and they never have peace. They've never had peace. But they keep trying to have peace and making treaties and ceasefires. But the Arabs, the radical Arabs, won't even admit that Israel is a state.
Yeah, there you go. December 7th, just a couple months after. Yeah, exactly 2 months after October 7th. But Mr. Fleury was saying that as just after Israel started its ground invasion, just after nobody was talking about a ceasefire or anything like that, when the mood was a lot more optimistic that Hamas was going to fold pretty fast. That was obviously well over a year ago now. And the circumstances have changed quite a bit. And now we're talking again about ceasefires, etc. And again, if you look at the specific phase one and what's happening there, there could be a lot of benefit in it for Israel if it all falls apart after that. But if it continues on and Hamas is able to outfox Israel and somehow stay in the Gaza Strip, then it's going to be another one of those deeply entrenched wounds where the remedy is the wound that we're talking about. But we don't just have the general trend of the Palestinians, etc., of like that there's going to be violence or whatever. The Bible also gives us a few more details about what's going to happen to Gaza specifically and some of the other foreign powers that are going to be interested in that. And the pertinent passage for that is Psalm 83, which speaks of a group of Middle Eastern peoples coming together. The verse 4 says, so that the name of Israel will be no more in remembrance. No alliance, either in the Bible or in secular history, has ever come together either for this purpose or for the composition. So this is why Mr. Fleury points to it being a prophecy. And verses 6 through 8 show which countries are going to be involved in this, or at least their ancestral names. Verse 6, the tabernacles of Edom and the Ishmaelites, of Moab and the Hagarines, Gebal and Ammon and Amalek, the Philistines are the inhabitants of Tyre. Asher also is joined with them. And this is what Mr. Fleury writes in his free book, The King of the South, quote, you must know who the modern descendants of these people are to understand just how timely and relevant this prophecy is. Here are the modern names of these nations as taught at Ambassador College under Herbert W. Armstrong. The Ishmaelites are Saudi Arabia, Moab and Ammon both refer to Jordan. The Hagarines anciently dwelt in the land known as Syria today. The Philistines are the modern Palestinian Arabs. Gebel and Tyre, Lebanon, and the people, one people listed here that lies outside the region is Asher, which is modern-day Germany, the ancestral people of Germany. And so because of that, Mr. Fleury has been focusing on the Palestinian people somehow to get into an alliance with a lot of moderate Arab countries that we just mentioned, and also Germany, and also Europe. He wrote further down into the book, the Philistines, the Palestinians of Gaza, and even those in the West Bank will shift their alliance to Germany as well. There may soon be some significant power shifts in Gaza. We published that book just a few months before October 7th happened, when the status quo was still as it was, and look what happened. And again, we don't necessarily have all the details with who's going to come in, if the ceasefire is going to stand, if who might end up coming picking up the pieces, but you're seeing this kind of thing happen right now. Before Gaza and Hamas, they were in the Iranian camp, and now Hezbollah's been decapitated. Iran has been backpedaling quite a bit. And Hamas, for their part, I mean, who knows if they'll be in charge of Gaza at this point or not, but they've been asking for Iran and Hezbollah and these other groups to come help them out quite a bit more, to actually participate on October 7th. And most of those proxies, they've given token levels of support, but not nearly the kind of help that Hamas has been hoping for. And I think that's staying in their memory a little bit. And I think they're maybe doing a bit of a recalculation of who their friends are and who their enemies are. We don't know exactly, again, what the immediate future holds, whether the ceasefire will hold, whether there'll be another deal offered. But one way or another, with or without Hamas, we expect Gaza to join in with Europe, to join in with these moderate Arab anti-Iranian groups. And this ceasefire, one way or another, if it goes through, if it falls apart, whatever, you could be sure is going to play a big part in that.
So these peace deals, ultimately, they're going to pave the way for Europe to come into the area. And I think at the time, maybe in Israel, they'll be looked at as a great success. I mean, some of the quotes that we read at the start, the way of peace they have not known. People say peace, peace, when there is no peace. And I think it's quite clear that Israel will be quite encouraged at Europe moving into the neighborhood. Great, we've got a friendly outside power coming in, and maybe they'll see these peace deals as being better than the ones in the past, different from the land for peace type deals where it's Israel gives terrorists territory in exchange for the terrorists not murdering them. This is, we've got Europe coming in and defending. It's a bit different. And that is going to then pave the way for what the Bible prophesies of just this incredible double cross, this incredible betrayal, where even these European forces that Israel has invited in comes in and betrays them. And all of that is in our free booklet, The King of the South. And I think you see the beginning of that already with these deals. So just today, I'll bring in a couple of European stories because they tie in directly to what you were just talking about. The European Union foreign policy chief, Kaya Kallas, she said that the EU is ready to monitor the Rafah border crossing between Gaza and Egypt. This was something that the EU, I think they stepped forward. They did that in 2005, only for a couple of years when Hamas won. The EU got out of there. It was a civilian-only mission. They didn't really want to mess with Hamas at that point. They've volunteered to come back. So you could see a peace deal in Gaza being an opening for the EU to come back into the area. And then also today, the French president, Emmanuel Macron, he's in Lebanon. You talked about the new Lebanese president, Joseph Aoun.
Is that Aoun.
Aoun. Okay, I'm glad I asked you. I'm completely my brain just goes lots of vowels. Let's rearrange letters to try and make it more pronounceable. But the president with too many vowels in his name, you were talking last week about how this opens the door for Europe to get involved in there, and you're right. A week later, Emmanuel Macron is his plane is landing in France. He's meeting with the Lebanese authorities. It was back in October that France had this big conference where they pledged to raise $1 billion in aid for Lebanon. And I think Lebanon is hoping that France can organize even more now that they've got a stable prime minister, president, they've got all of these top jobs sorted.
Before we move on, one of the big stories I wanted to mention else in the Middle East is actually
with Lebanon.
I was going to say we have a new prime minister in Lebanon too, at this point the caretaker government in Lebanon has been controlled by Hezbollah. By this point, the new president, he doesn't have many powers. One of the few powers he has is to put the decision maker in, the prime minister, and he picked Nawaf Salam, who is the former head of the International Court of Justice, based in The Hague, one of these multilateral international institutions that has huge connections with Europe. So again, you can see how that's even looking more tantalizing for people like Macron to come in and start doing things.
Yeah, I think it's trying to get more money from Europe is a big part of the reason why he appointed such an internationally known rather than domestically known individual. I'm glad. I thought you were going to take us into a completely different country, but I'm glad you pointed that out. I think that is that is a good point. But I think this is all of this is happened after Israel signed their ceasefire with Hezbollah. And that also is on a lot of Macron's agenda, trying to make sure that this ceasefire with Hezbollah holds I think it reaches another stage within the next couple of weeks. And so there's, you know, okay, what's going to happen there? And Europe would very much like this to remain in place. So here, I think you'd absolutely see an Israeli ceasefire opening the door for a European power to move into the area. So long run, yeah, like, okay, maybe this may well just be like the earlier ceasefire in Gaza, just a pause in the war, a new phase in the war. It might be the end of the war, too soon to say. But in the long run, these peace deals, unless Israel wakes up and starts looking to God for its security instead of other nations, they're going to be a trap. And trying to negotiate with terrorists like this just never works out. Did you have any other Middle Eastern stories, or have we kind of hit them all in there?
One more I wanted to mention. Actually, today, the Iranian president, Masoud Pezeshkian, is in Moscow to sign a 20-year comprehensive strategic partnership treaty with Vladimir Putin's Russia. What exactly does that mean? They're being, at least last time I checked, they're pretty vague on the details, but it involves different cooperations in military spheres, economic spheres, and nuclear spheres. Similar to the agreement with North Korea, except as I think with the North Korean case, they pledged not that an attack on one is an attack on both. I don't think they made the same thing with Iran. Ultimately, I think this is a little bit more hyped up than it should be. Iran and Russia already have agreements like that and have already been doing this kind of intimate, that you're seeing Iranian drones being used in Ukraine. Russia's been helping out Iran do shifty things with a nuclear program for a while. So this is not so much any big new explosive development, but it is a sign that we're seeing Iran graft itself in with these more powerful super anti-American superpowers. And when you combine those two, again, like we're seeing in Ukraine, bad things happen.
And related to that, there was this story the Times had earlier in the week, or I think it was the Sunday Times, that there were secret flights going on between Iran and Russia, and that you had one of the Supreme Leader's top aides coming backwards and forwards between the two. And I thought they had some interesting speculation there where they were like, Iran does not need Russia's help to get the bomb, but Russia could help them miniaturize it. They could help them make a more sophisticated bomb, that kind of thing.
I also suspect there's probably more begging on Putin's part for more help with Ukraine. I highly doubt we're going to see 10,000 Iranians like we do North Koreans to become cannon fodder, but you are seeing Russia get a lot more desperate trying to find men from different places, like even kidnapping them from Cuba without the Cuban government's knowledge. That was a while back, or some of these other African countries. So I think some of that might also definitely play a part in it as well.
All right. Well, thank you for that, Mihailo. We've been talking about a couple of, I've been talking about the Middle Eastern peace deal. Now we can move on to a peace deal that I know Andrew and I have both been watching pretty closely. One that has come out for the United States this week, and that is this big announcement that on the way out of office, Joe Biden has taken Cuba off of the list of state sponsors of terrorism and has unlocked a whole lot of extra funds for Cuba. So what can you tell us about this? I guess it's not a peace deal in that there was no war going on between Cuba and the United States, but certainly there's a deal there to lower tensions and bring these two closer together.
And it's definitely a very naive deal, something that's not the first time this has been happened. Barack Obama did a similar deal. There's kind of been a new tradition in American politics to where on the president's first day in office, he has to use a flurry of executive orders to undo everything his predecessor did. And then as the president leaves office, he's doing a flurry of executive orders to try to make his predecessor's job as hard as possible. This is one of those deals. Biden, he's going to be out of office in 3 days. He could have left well enough alone and just let the new incoming administration deal with this the way they saw fit. But instead, he decided on his way out the door to take Cuba off America's terrorist watch list, or I guess more accurately, its list of terrorist sponsoring states. Cuba historically has been a huge sponsor of terrorism, not as big as Iran, which has long held the record for the world's biggest state sponsor of terrorism. But Cuba has sponsored communist terrorist movements around the world for decades. There's not really any good evidence that they've stopped. but Biden decided to take them off this list anyway. I guess his stated rationale, like you said, is to lower tensions. If they're not on the list of state-sponsored terror organizations, some of the financial sanctions we have on Cuba will go away, which will bring more money and investment to prop the nation up. And another bunch of domino effects like that really just make it easier for America to have a closer relationship with Cuba.
And I think, yeah, label Cuba to get more money. And like, if you're a business, you're kind of going to think twice before doing business with or selling to a country that's on the U.S. state sponsor of terrorism list. Certainly, if you're not the kind of country, business that's big enough to have big lawyers and things like that. And then I think also there was a couple of memos that Donald Trump had put in place earlier about not doing business with groups that are affiliated with the Cuban government, Cuban military, that they signed there. So I think this really got our eyes, I think, because of what Barack Obama did, and because what Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry said about the Barack Obama deal as well. We've got a quick clip that we can play now from a Key of David that he did closer to when Barack Obama made his Cuba deal.
The U.S. has made a deal with Cuba, and they're trying to normalize relations there with Cuba. But I think both political parties don't realize how dangerous, and I mean extremely dangerous, this deal with Cuba really is, and the potential it has for disaster.
So quite some strong statements there from Mr. Flurry. So, I mean, what are the potential for the disaster? What's the big danger here?
Well, yeah, that was definitely a really great point Mr. Flurry made about both parties not recognizing the danger from Cuba. Democrats definitely don't. Even Republicans don't recognize it as deeply as they should. Because in an issue like this, like we've already covered, if Cuba is sponsoring terrorism and we take our sanctions off them, then you can have American business money flowing through Cuba to terrorists around the world. That's the most immediate danger that even some of the Republicans realize. But there's actually three other aspects about Cuba, just solely based on where it's located, that make it extremely important, way more important than you'd initially think before you look into it, to the United States. One is it's close enough to the United States that if a foreign power were to put nuclear bombs there, like the Soviets tried to do during the Kennedy administration, those nuclear bombs could be launched at the United States without attaining the altitude required, and they could hit the United States without maintaining the altitude required for our anti-ballistic missile shields to shoot them down. Like, if you shoot a nuclear bomb from Moscow to the U.S., that thing's going to be up in the stratosphere before it lands. Really easy for a satellite to detect it and neutralize it before it gets here.
I mean, I wouldn't say easy. Like, I remember I delved into some of the documents on where they'd done interception tests, and it was basically, they always did the tests during daylight when they made sure the interceptors knew they were coming. And like, there's a lot of people, I think, that are kind of skeptical that it might not work as well as advertised in real life conditions. But I think your point is a really good one, that if those are kind of hard to shoot down, there's no way you're intercepting something from Cuba. This is many orders of magnitude more difficult to intercept than something coming from the Soviet Union or from Russia.
Right. And so, I mean, most of our listeners have probably heard of the Cuban Missile Crisis. That was the big scare, because you're like, the Soviets had missiles in Russia that could shoot at us, and the technology to get them here. But the fact that they'd put them in Cuba was an order of magnitude more dangerous for the United States. So you do not want to let a hostile foreign power get a foothold in Cuba. For that reason, also for the reason is that Cuba is tied into some of our internet and phone networks. And so purely from an espionage standpoint, Cuba's extremely significant. The Soviets had a spy station in Cuba for years. I think it might even still exist down there with some Russian or Chinese investment. That it's really easy that if you're trying to intercept American telecommunications, Cuba is strategically located. And then the final reason it's so important and is a big one is that when you look at the statistics for maritime trade coming to the United States, about half of that trade flows through the Gulf of Mexico. The other half is pretty evenly divided between the Atlantic coast and the Pacific coast. But America has three coastlines, a Pacific coast, a Gulf coast, and an Atlantic coast. And that Gulf coast is probably the most important from a trade standpoint, not only because half the trade goes there, but the thing, the Gulf of Mexico, or the Gulf of America, as Trump now calls it, it's basically shaped as a, it's like a wine bottle where Cuba's the cork. You've got maybe a 90-mile strait on either side, the Yucatan Strait and the Straits of Florida. So if you could get a hostile foreign power, Russia, China, the European Union, that's got control of Cuba, not only can they spy on us and launch nuclear bombs at us, they can also cut off like half of our maritime trade. So it's just really extremely important for America to maintain control of Cuba. And deals like this, and I mean, I guess some liberals or Democrats might even argue that like, oh, well, if we take them off the state-sponsored terror list and draw them closer into our orbit, that might make it less likely for a foreign power to get in charge. But that doesn't necessarily follow if Cuba is still a state sponsor of terrorism. Because if they're already working with our enemies, and now we start take them off the state sponsor of terror list and sending them money, that's not a guarantee that they're going to switch over to our side to get more money. They could just take the money and give it to our enemies. We started this program with like a way of peace they know not. There may be some officials be like, well, this is how we have peace with Cuba, but giving money to someone who hates you and wants you to die is not it's an appeasement strategy. It's not a way that's actually going to bring peace.
Yeah, that's an important point. Just while you were talking as well, I, using the power of Google, looked up a couple of things. One is, so ICBM flight times, if you're launching a missile on America from Russia, it would take 30 minutes to 40 minutes to arrive. So that's the amount of time that America would have to decide, uh-oh, we've got nuclear weapons showing up on our detection systems. Is this fake? Is this real? We've got to press the button to launch our ones back at Russia. They have that long to decide. From Cuba, this is according to the John F. Kennedy Presidential Library and Museum, a missile launch from Cuba would reach most U.S. cities in under 5 minutes. So,
wow.
Like, you can certainly see with the Cuban Missile Crisis how deadly that was, because Russia could very well have taken the view, and I think you look at what Khrushchev said and think, like, they probably would have taken the view, we think we can launch these missiles at America and wipe them out before they have time to respond. That they're not going to have time in those 5 minutes to verify that this is indeed a true alarm and not a false alarm, and then get the message to the president and have the president authorize a nuclear counterstrike, and that just 5 minutes is too short. So that's one danger. And then also, you know, there's a couple of shows that we've done recently where you've been talking about the importance of Panama, that it's important for U.S. trade with the world, that it's important with U.S. trade with the U.S., that because of just so much goods travel between America via sea. And it feels like everything that you said there applies to Cuba, that Cuba is this big island in the middle of the Gulf of America, if we're going to call it that now, that dominates the same kind of trade, which is really interesting to see this come up now. Like, if America gains control of the Panama Canal, but a foreign power has Cuba, that kind of negates a whole lot of the advantage of getting the Panama Canal back. But another aspect of this, and this is what I was probably focusing on, maybe a little bit more because this ties in a bit more with Europe, is that the Vatican and the Catholic Church played a major role in negotiating this deal. And this is fascinating because they played a major role in Barack Obama's deal as well. And Mr. Flurry talked a lot about that at the time. And then even since in the years since then, you kind of had retiring cardinals come out and say, yeah, actually the Pope played an even bigger role than was revealed at the time. And I was going in and out of the back door of the White House, carrying letters from the Pope and kind of doing the shuttle diplomacy. And I was visiting the US president. And then I was going to Cuba and visiting the authorities there. Like, under Barack Obama, the Catholic Church made it happen. And it's the same this time. And the Catholic Church played a major role here. So the Biden administration announced these changes. And then at the same time, Cuba announced that they were going to release 553 out of an estimated 1,000 political prisoners. And the one that Mr. Flurry calls the French lady, White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre, she called the deal an understanding with the Catholic Church. The Cuban president, when he published his documents, he promised the Pope in a letter earlier this month that he would release political prisoners. The Cuba's foreign ministry says that this deal happened, or that the prisoner release happened against the backdrop of a close and fluid relations with the Vatican State, and that Cuba has a respectful, frank, and constructive dialogue with the Vatican and the Supreme Pontiff, which facilitates decisions such as the one recently taken. Just like the 2014-2015 Cuba deal, you had cardinals playing a big role. So Cardinal Sean O'Malley, he was the Archbishop of Boston until last summer. After the deal came out this week, he wrote, "Over the past several years, I've carried messages from Pope Francis to the presidents of the United States and Cuba." And he credited Pope Francis's patient and persistent efforts as an underlying force in bringing about this historic agreement. So, you know, this is part of a diplomatic negotiation with the Catholic Church. And it raises this question, why does the Catholic Church have such a strong, consistent focus on Cuba? And I think part of that is, say, Cuba's treatment of Catholics. Like, this has, the Catholic Church has had more doors open to them in Cuba. I think 2019, the Catholic Church opened its first ever church in Cuba since the Cuban Revolution. Freedom House notes, "Cuba's one-party communist state outlaws political pluralism, bans independent media, suppresses dissent, and severely restricts basic civil liberties." But then it says the regime's undemocratic character has not changed. It says it's not changed anyway, that despite these deals that Barack Obama did, they're still undemocratic. They've got a new constitution. None of this has really changed. But it does say, however, the Roman Catholic Church has enjoyed an expansion of its pastoral rights, including periodic access to state media and the ability to build new churches. Protestant and evangelical groups tend to face greater restrictions, though they too have experienced improved conditions in recent years. Now, I don't want to kind of give a false impression. There is still some government persecution of some Catholics within Cuba. But you can see how the Pope's relationship there has gained the Catholic Church a lot of freedom. But I think there's much more to it than merely freedom of worship for the Catholic Church. And that is where what you were talking about Cuba's geopolitical standpoint, about its crucial crossroads within trade come into the story. So I think that's an important angle, that this is a very strategic island that is part of the Catholic Church's interest. I think, Mahaida, you had something you wanted to say on this.
Yes, I also think it's interesting that it coincides with a story you reported on recently about how Pope Francis received the Presidential Medal of Freedom with distinction, one of, I believe, only six or seven people in the history of the award to ever get it, one of them being Joe Biden himself.
Yeah, I couldn't believe that when I saw that.
But the fact that the U.S. gave Pope Francis the most highest award, or the president gave the most highest award he possibly could at the same time this deal was announced, I don't... Like that there's definitely some optics and some subliminal messaging going on there about just how important this deal is for Washington as well.
Yeah, that's true. I think it's really interesting that Joe Biden would have been visiting the Pope last weekend were it not for the California fires, and I think he would have conferred the Presidential Medal of Freedom in person. Mm-hmm. Maybe we would have seen some of this Cuba deal done on that trip or announced on that trip with the Pope at his side. If that had gone ahead. So, yeah, I think this closeness between the Biden administration and the Pope is important to watch. And it's also important to see, like, this is a pretty anti-American Pope. That's why I thought it was pretty outrageous that he was given the Medal of Freedom. You know, he's called capitalism a new tyranny. Even a lot of Catholics themselves have pointed out capitalism has been the most successful economic system for lifting people out of poverty that mankind has ever come up with. And the Pope has repeatedly condemned it and attacked it. He's talked about there being an urgent need of a true world political authority. He's talked about the global financial system needing to be replaced with something more socialist. You know, if America really is a new tyranny, if capitalism is a new tyranny, does that mean America is a tyrant? If America is the world's most prominent capitalist power. And then under him, the church has been way less critical of Cuba's government. And he said, "I am a communist and so too is Jesus." That's a quote from Pope Francis. So I think it is worth seeing the danger of the Catholic Church getting more control of Cuba. And then, of course, Cuba was part of the very Catholic Habsburg Empire. The Spanish Empire, they dominated that island. In fact, it was key for their trade with Latin America. It was kind of the entrance and exit point. It dominated a whole lot of the sea lanes. So when you see the Catholic Church moving into Cuba, it's also a bit, they are well aware of the history and the importance of that island for dominating American trade. And so we've talked about sea gates quite a bit on this show. This is where you have all of these prophecies about a siege. Well, Cuba could very well play and almost certainly will play a very important part of that siege. And this story, Mr. Flurry had a lot to say about that in his book, Great Again. There's a whole chapter on that, chapter 4, The Deadly Deal with Cuba, about this earlier deal that Barack Obama signed with Cuba. He says, "The Bible prophesies of a deadly economic siege that is going to strike America. It will cause one-third of the terrifying damage that will be suffered in the Great Tribulation. That siege is about somebody controlling trade routes, so it is not difficult to see how Cuba could play a strategic role in that." He also said, "The German-led European Union is the seventh and final resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire, the same Holy Roman Empire which centuries ago used Cuba so powerfully to fuel its wars. If the persistent resurrections were to move into Cuba again, or the present resurrection were to move into Cuba again, it would be well positioned to carry out these kind of attacks. The advantage is that it can do so within a cloak of secrecy, since Cuba is essentially a police state with tight controls on information. Think of the control it could have. Think of how valuable Cuba has been to America's enemies in the past. You need to watch what is happening in Cuba." Statements like that that have caused us to pay such close attention to this deal. Anyway, Andrew, sorry, I kind of took that and ran with it quite a bit on the Pope. Did you have anything else, any other aspects of this you wanted to bring up?
Yeah, well, it's definitely important to remember that the Catholic Church, it's a very unique church. And because on the one hand, it is a church like the Methodist Church or the Presbyterian Church or the Lutheran Church or the Baptist Church. But on the other hand, it's also a state in Europe, Vatican State. So the Pope, he's both a bishop and a king. And so some of these deals like he's doing with Biden in Cuba are not the traditional thing that the bishop of a church would do, but it's more diplomatic relations between the King of Vatican City and the United States over a third nation. And obviously, Vatican City, it's in Europe, it's in Italy, it's surrounded by Italy. So it's always going to be biased towards the European Union. So you get a Catholic deal over trying to Cuba, and that deal, it's not really designed to benefit the United States so much as it's designed to benefit Europe. And it's part of the Pope's bigger strategy for the Americas. Another part of this strategy is encouraging more illegal immigration. He actually, another story I've been watching is the Archbishop of Washington, D.C., that's the capital of the United States, so the most important Catholic Archbishop of the United States, just is getting ready to retire. The Pope was reportedly going to replace him with Sean McKnight. And then Trump won the election. And when he won the election, he decided to replace him with Bishop McElroy instead, Robert McElroy. And Robert McElroy, here in the United States, he's well known for being probably the most outspoken critic against Donald Trump's immigration policy. About 8 years ago, he said, "For us as the Catholic community in the United States, it's unthinkable that we will stand by while more than 10% of our flock is ripped from our midst and deported." So that's a public admission by the new Archbishop of Washington, D.C., that about 10% of the Catholics in the United States are illegal immigrants. And so you can see just from a self-interest standpoint that if Trump says that, like, well, these people broke the laws passed by Congress when they came here and they need to be deported, that he, along with the U.S. Catholic Bishops Conference, is going to do everything in their power to stop those deportations from happening. Actually, the president of the Bishops Conference, Archbishop Jose Gomez, has been even more honest. Just he doesn't hide what he thinks. He's just really honest with the approach, where he said, he's like, actually, he said, if you look at American history, America was formed by, it's kind of like the form by a clash of two cultures. You've got the, what he calls, in his words, the Anglo-Protestant culture and the Hispano-Catholic culture. So the Founding Fathers, the Pilgrims, New England, all of these people were English colonists, English Puritans coming over here to forge a new nation. At the same time, down in Texas and California, you had citizens of the Holy Roman Empire under Charles V and his successors coming in that way. So the Bishops' Conference has basically said, he's published a new book saying, he said, the solution to America's problems is less Anglo-Protestant culture and more Hispano-Celtic culture. And so if that means helping millions of illegals cross the border, that may not be what Congress wants, that may not be what Donald Trump wants, that may not be what the Make America Great Again movement wants, but the U.S. Catholic Bishops Conference definitely wants that because they think it's for an America's own good. And so you look at what the new Archbishop of Washington, D.C. is saying, you look at what the president of the U.S. Catholic Bishops Conference is saying, you combine it with the deals that Pope Francis is brokering over Cuba, and you really do get a vivid picture of that Deuteronomy 28, verse 52, economic siege. You could even combine what the European Union's doing with Mercosur, that trade deal there. It's like you're looking at that. The European Union and the Mercosur Trade Alliance need to merge together into the world's biggest free trade zone. Using the power of the Catholic Church, that free trade zone needs to include Cuba, because that's the gateway for half of America's maritime trade. And we need to let as many Latin Americans come into the United States, legally or illegally, as possible, because it's part of like a bigger, like, trade, political, religious strategy to besiege America, but more specifically, as Gomez would phrase it, to besiege the Anglo-Protestant culture that the Founding Fathers built America on.
I think this is fascinating. Like, you see the battle lines of a trade war being drawn now. And I think, to Donald Trump's great credit, he sees the danger of trade war, the importance of trade, the danger of America being cut off from trade. And so he had, like, no one else. No, I can't think of any other prominent politician who would have blown up the issue of the Panama Canal as being a big deal right now. And I think there's tremendous insight from him and his team to have really focused on, we need the Panama Canal. I think even Greenland, I've talked before, you know, it's kind of treated as a bit of a joke and a funny story, but really, you know, he has an excellent focus on controlling these kind of trade routes. And then with China, okay, he's got a focus there on dealing with the way that China uses trade as a weapon, uses its cheap labor to kind of attack the United States, blackmail the United States and other countries. They use it as a weapon. He sees that. But now you see these other battle lines being drawn. You see Europe coming into Latin America with Mercosur. You see the Pope negotiating this Cuba deal. And then there's even a smaller story this week where China and Europe were having this summit and were getting much closer together and kind of, you know, praising each other. You see these battle lines being drawn. And whether or not, like, who wins this battle, though, is going to come down not to tariff policies ultimately or military strength. This is what Mr. Flurry focused on in his Key of David on the Panama Canal, and I believe he's got an article in the upcoming Trumpet print edition. It comes down to fearing God and to repentance, and that America has the Panama Canal as a blessing given to a man who feared God, a blessing to Abraham and his descendants. And so if America repents, if America turns to God, if America changes its behavior, they can win that trade war. And they can have God intervene. If not, God is allowing everything to line up so that you have the rise of the Holy Roman Empire and so that you have this terrible siege that is, I think, worse than anyone imagines that the Bible describes. And, you know, you talked about the Catholic Church. The Bible does talk about a woman, a symbol of a church that goes around and has all of these dealings with world leaders. And, you know, God's church in the Bible is described as a little flock. He says, fear not, little flock. But this woman that has all of these negotiating treaties with kings and heads of state, and that the Bible has a lot to say about that church as well. And that's described in Revelation chapter 17 and Revelation 13. It describes what this church is doing. And so our free booklet, The Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy, or our free book, that's a fairly substantial book, shows you what this church is, what this is doing. And so you're seeing this clash building between the United States and the Holy Roman Empire. It's coming. And the outcome of that clash depends on repentance. And ultimately the outcome for you depends on your action and repentance. Even if the nation itself doesn't repent, well, every individual, God will look after those that do repent, that do turn to him. He doesn't want to inflict more suffering and punishment than he has to. And that is ultimately what is most important here. Did you have anything else or any more stories, Andrew, to touch on quickly before we head on over to Jeremiah?
Yeah, I'll do a quick rundown of three more stories, other things happening in the Anglo-American region. We're getting some more revelations about the corrupt Biden family that is now leaving office. Special Counsel David Weiss finally released his full report on the crimes of Hunter Biden. That report was delayed after Joe Biden pardoned his son Hunter. So there may not be any legal action taken on this report, but just for the public record, for the Americans to see how bad things got under Biden administration, the report is being released. At the same time, these devastating wildfires in California have not gone out yet. That's something we talked about a lot on last week's program, a crisis that's still ongoing. and may end up being the most damaging natural disaster in U.S. history. The latest estimates I've seen suggest that it's going to cost between $2 billion and $3 billion, probably about $2.5 billion, which is going to be a huge financial curse on the insurance companies in California that now have to start shelling out claims for these thousands of buildings that have been incinerated. And then one final update on America's other trade war, the trade war that's happening north of us. We've had some good news for the Trump administration there. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau got all the premiers of the Canadian provinces together in a plan to try to come up with retaliatory tariffs against the United States, and determine that really the only thing that America needs from Canada that might get some effect is oil exports. So they're trying to pressure Alberta into putting a tariff on oil to the United States, which didn't make a ton of sense to me considering the fact that Canada has no oil pipelines connecting Alberta to Ontario. All of eastern Canada's oil flows from Alberta into the United States through Michigan and into Canada. So if you threaten to cut off oil to the United States, you're basically threatening to cut off oil to the part of your own country where people live, because it has to come through here. For environmental reasons, they've never approved a pipeline through Ontario. The Alberta Prime Minister, though, was smart enough to see through all this, realizing that the Eastern Canadians need use of that pipeline and realizing that Alberta's economy is so dependent on the United States that she's broken ranks with the other Canadian provinces and would not sign Justin Trudeau's retaliatory tariff measurements. She said the rest of Canada can put retaliatory tariffs on the United States if they want to, but Alberta's committed towards negotiating with Trump to try to come up with some sort of deal that will keep the energy trade between the United Nations tariff free. And so we'll see. I think Trump might be doing this on purpose. We've talked quite a bit about like the clash between cultures, between Hispanic America and Anglo America. And I think Trump's realized that his threat of tariffs is exacerbating the divisions between Eastern Canada and Western Canada. And Western Canada is aligning more with the Make America Great Again movement. Which could end up being prophetic. We've talked about God's going to lead a temporary economic resurgence through this Jeroboam figure. Canada will likely be included in the economic resurgence if they line up behind the Jeroboam. And now, for the past many years, Canada has been very against whatever Trump's tried to do. And we're finally starting to see some of the Western provinces, or at least singular province in this case, Alberta, break away from the liberal political consensus in Ottawa and trying to make overtures towards the United States and Donald Trump that could really set up an Anglo power bloc in the northern part of Latin America for this Hispanic European power bloc to clash with.
Well, Alberta, it's kind of Canada's Texas anyway. But while we're on the subject of Canada, if you do want some more Canada coverage, we will be airing our exclusive, I guess, because no, we didn't do it with any other publication, so we probably call it that, our exclusive interview with Maxime Bernier. He sat down and talked to me earlier in the week, so we're very excited to air that next week. That will be the Wednesday show. So he is the leader of the People's Party of Canada and could well play an important role in the upcoming Canadian election. So we've got a great discussion with him for you for Wednesday's show. All right, well, we've talked a lot about peace deals, negotiations. Jeremiah, you have a story today that I think drives home the stakes of, well, what really is at stake when we're talking about bringing about peace in this day and age.
Yes, that's right. And the story is that Russia and China are pushing the world back into the fallout zone, you know, into a new era when the prospect of nuclear war is looming large once again. Now, the world has, of course, never really left the nuclear era ever since these unfathomably destructive weapons were first designed and mass-produced last century. But there was a time a few decades back when the leaders of Russia and America and other nations started to recognize that the threat was just too grave, the stakes were just too high, and that these doomsday devices were far too destructive to keep on building more and more of them. So back at that time, the Russians and Americans began paring down their arsenals, and some landmark treaties were enacted to limit the construction and the use of these weapons. In the 1990s, Russia even began dismantling a lot of its nuclear warheads, and it would actually downblend that highly enriched uranium and then sell it to the United States for use in American nuclear power plants. So it was a program called Megatons to Megawatts, turning weapons of annihilation into fuel to power life. So all of this made it seem for years like we were stepping back from the brink. But that time is now over. On Monday, the Wall Street Journal published a powerful piece called "The Bomb is Back as the Risk of Nuclear War Enters a New Age." And that might sound a little bit hyperbolic, but really evidence of this new nuclear era is everywhere. You've got Russia talking about and considering more and more the use of tactical nuclear weapons in Ukraine, just to give it a battlefield advantage. We've also had Russia recently deploy nuclear weapons to Belarus. And Russia has been openly violating the INF treaty. That's the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. They were violating that for some time, which finally led to the treaty's collapse a couple of years back. And now Russian President Vladimir Putin has announced that he's pulling out of the New START treaty as well. So that one will be toast in about a year. And those two treaties, the INF and the New START, they were the main pillars of the efforts to reduce the nuclear threat. They put all kinds of limitations on the deployment and use of these weapons, but now they're gone. And that revives the potential of a new nuclear arms race between Russia and the United States. And then the Chinese, meanwhile, are not waiting for a starting gun. Since 2015, China has doubled its arsenal of nuclear-tipped ICBMs. That brings the current count to about 600. And every one of these can strike the United States mainland, according to the Pentagon's latest assessment of Chinese military power. Chinese leaders also consistently reject proposals to meet with American authorities just about discussing placing formal limits on nuclear weapons. And China's pace of building new ones just keeps on increasing. We expect them to hit 1,000 very soon. And then China also recently became the world's third nation after the US and Russia to achieve a nuclear triad, which means the capability to deliver nuclear weapons by land, sea, and air. And of course, it's not just Russia and China. In recent months, Iran has also kept pushing its nuclear development ahead. This utterly fanatical regime could be mere months away from having a nuclear bomb. There's also North Korea, another fanatical regime, which is expanding its nuclear arsenal and making some big strides in improving its delivery systems for nuclear weapons. You've also got Germany, where military personnel have been receiving more and more training about how to drop the nuclear bombs that America has stocked in Germany. And then there's Pakistan, where more concerns are coming up about how vulnerable its nuclear weapons are to terrorist hijacking, especially since the United States has now pulled out of neighboring Afghanistan. And then on top of all that, you've got discussions underway in a lot of countries about obtaining nuclear arsenals of their own for the first time. We see that happening in Japan, Saudi Arabia, South Korea, Taiwan, Turkey, and Ukraine as well. So it's plain to see that the bomb is back. It's thanks mostly to Russia and China, but also due to developments in several other nations. And this means the shadow of the mushroom cloud looms large once again.
And this is something, you know, I was going to go and look for something from the Key of David on this show, because I was like, oh, I know Mr. Flurry has talked about this quite a lot. And I didn't even have to look, because I was looking through his show on Cuba. And, well, this is what he had to say on this exact subject in that Cuba show.
Sometimes we act like there's no danger of nuclear warfare, and I think we're in many ways afraid to even discuss it when these bombs are just being proliferating all over the world, and the terrorists are certain to get control of them, and terror-sponsoring nations are going to get control of them, just like Iran is about to.
And this is a very real problem. That because it's so big, and I think it's so big and scary, we don't want to think about. I think there's also a complacency in that people look at this and say, we've had bombs for 80 years. If we were going to blow ourselves up, we'd have done it by now. That there's kind of like we just have gotten used to these nuclear weapons. But a big reason to really stay alert still about these nuclear weapons and what's going on here is, well, the Bible and even Jesus Christ himself talked about nuclear weapons. They talked about weapons that mankind would have that would give mankind the ability to destroy the planet, to destroy himself, which is an incredible prophecy, because there is no way a human mind living 2,000 years ago in a world where the most destructive weapon would be like an onager, like a type of catapult or something, like that, to be able to foresee that future. So the Bible is a powerful reason as well to take these weapons seriously.
That's a very good point. Yes, if you look at Bible prophecy, there are passages that talk about a war that will soon break out. And Matthew 24 says that it'll be so destructive that it will have the potential to erase all human life from the planet. So from that detail, we can be sure that this is talking about nuclear war, with so many nuclear weapons detonated that it triggers a nuclear winter. So when we see Russia right now violating treaties and putting nuclear weapons in Belarus and talking about using tactical nuclear weapons in Ukraine, and when we see China in overdrive to expand its nuclear arsenal and refusing to sign any kind of treaties about that, and when we see all these other developments that we've mentioned in other nations, all of that shows us that this war is approaching. And that is as alarming a reality as anything we could imagine. But those same prophecies tell us that this nuclear war will not wipe out mankind. You know, they tell us that the war will actually be interrupted by the most momentous event that the world has ever experienced. And Mr. Flurry has written an entire booklet about this subject. It's called Nuclear Armageddon is at the Door. And he goes through the prophecies about the very devastating war, of course, in that booklet. But he also devotes a lot of space to the good news, you know, to that interruption and what comes after it. So I hope that listeners will visit thetrumpet.com and order their free copy of Nuclear Armageddon is at the Door.
Well, thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. Did you have any other Asia stories you wanted to give us before we wrap up?
A couple of quick ones. Yes, first up, a story with some sobering implications for Taiwan, and that is that China is now building a fleet of special D-Day style barges that looked to be designed specifically for an amphibious attack. This was reported by Naval News a couple of days ago, and it's based on satellite imagery of China's shipyard in Guangzhou. And China might be making as many as 6 of these massive barges, and they would be perfect for an invasion of Taiwan. They have bridges almost 400 feet long, which would let troops kind of bypass beaches that might be mined or otherwise difficult to land on. The barges also have massive pillars that stabilize them on the seafloor, even in very bad weather. So these could move great numbers of soldiers and trucks and tanks and weapons onto Taiwan. And the fact that China is suddenly focusing on the construction of these barges so much could mean that the invasion of Taiwan might be nearer than most of us would like to think. And then another quick China story here about their economy. The Chinese economy is suffering through some tough times right now, but despite that, or actually according to some economists, because of that, China has just posted a trade surplus with the rest of the world of almost $1 trillion. So that is just a remarkable gap between Chinese imports and exports. And the Wall Street Journal wrote about this, saying, "For Washington and its allies, this ascendancy shows that efforts to reduce their dependence on China are coming up short. That suggests it'll remain hard for Trump to rebalance U.S.-China trade relations, even if he pushes tariffs higher," end quote. And President Trump, of course, has threatened to impose more serious tariffs on Chinese goods sold in the U.S. He's talked about 60% on those tariffs. But this Wall Street Journal article says that this massive surplus in China means that the Chinese have a $1 trillion head start in any kind of tariff fight. So this shows that it won't be easy for the U.S. to press China to rebalance its trade. And it shows that China is coming into Trump's second term with some real economic leverage on the table.
Well, thank you for that, Jeremiah. Those are some really interesting other stories that you brought us as well. Well, I wanted to wrap this episode up. You know, we've talked about efforts at peace negotiation and efforts that fall short, peace negotiations that are traps, peace negotiations that make the world more dangerous. Then we brought in nuclear weapons. I mean, if we can't negotiate peace, and if we don't know the way of peace, what hope is there in a world full of nuclear destruction? I think if we just ended the show right on that note, that's a pretty bleak ending. But I wanted to point you to just one more little booklet that I think is great for this week, and that is The Way of Peace Restored Momentarily. And you'll see on the front cover there's Herbert W. Armstrong sitting down with, I think that's the Egyptian president Anwar Sadat next to him. And this book is about the fact that there is a way of peace. Okay, there's a way of peace that mankind doesn't know about, but God has a way of peace, and God reveals that way of peace in the Bible. And God had an individual come and explain and even demonstrate this way of peace and what this looks like. And that man was Herbert W. Armstrong, and he died on January 16th, 1986. And this week is the episode of his death. And that's why I think this book is just especially a perfect conclusion to what we've been talking about this week. You know, there is a way to bring peace. We have had all of this destruction. We have had all of these destructive peace negotiations, things that are going wrong. But there is a genuine solution, and there is a way to bring peace, and God has revealed it. And that's a way that you can employ and bring peace into your life as well. It's not just theoretical, it's not just international. And so God has solutions. He has solutions for the nations. If the nations don't listen, he has solutions for you. And he can and will work with you individually. And it's just a short little booklet. It's only 30 pages. And so it's an easy read, an easy takeaway to study and learn more about Mr. Armstrong this week, and to learn, more importantly, more about God and his way of peace and his solutions. That other booklet that we heard from Jeremiah as well, Nuclear Armageddon, it's at the door. That's another short little book. We'll put links to both of those in our show notes. We mentioned The King of the South earlier in the week, earlier in the show. It hasn't been a week long. We have gone a little over time. Maybe it does feel like a week to some of our viewers. You can read that. You can get that as well. We're very happy to send you any of those booklets. You can get them at our website, thetrumpet.com. You can read them online. You can add them to your basket and check out. And don't worry, you know, we use those terms that you're familiar with from e-commerce, but it is free. It is absolutely free. We just need your address to send it to you. And we ship those anywhere in the world with no shipping costs. It's, you know, having a print copy means you can study it with your Bible and prove it for yourself. And we're very happy to provide that. So you can get those on our website. You can email us, trumpetworld@thetrumpet.com, if you want to get in touch. Thank you so much to all of our panelists. Thank you to George Haddad and Isaac Lorenz for engineering and production. We've got our recorded show lined up with Maxime Bernier for Wednesday. So please do join us then. And until then, keep watching your world.